It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, an effort to confront economic challenges facing the state's northern counties.
But first, Tony Award-winning actress and singer Kristen Chenoweth is coming to Wisconsin this weekend. She'll be performing at Madison's Overture Center this Sunday, October 4th.
Chenoweth has a couple of Tony Awards to her name, including one for her role as Glinda the Good Witch in the Broadway musical Wicked. She's been a regular on the TV show Glee and won an Emmy Award for acting on the show Pushing Daisies.
This Sunday, she'll be joined by Wisconsin high school students from Overture's Tommy Ensemble.
She joins us now. Kristen Chenoweth, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
You started out in opera, a scholarship from the Metropolitan Opera auditions, a lot going on there, and then you went into musical theater. What led you to make that big switch?
Well, I went sort of on a haphazard audition in New York with my best friend just to see what it was like, and I was supposed to be in Philadelphia starting Academy of Vocal Arts Conservatory, and a couple weeks before the program, I went in and auditioned for a show in New York, and ended up getting the part and had a decision to make. And I really thought a lot about it, and everything I've ever approached, any role I've ever done, has always been about the role and the acting and the character of it. And I just felt like that was my first love. And I was also a dancer, and I just, I'd always wanted to be on Broadway, but I'd had success in other areas, and I just followed my heart, and I moved to New York, and I didn't have an agent or anything. I just went in there, and my dad negotiated my contract because I didn't have anybody to do it, and then through that show and those reviews, I got an agent, and looking back now, I know that that's just extremely luck, talent, blessed, right place at the right time, all of it comes together. If you tried to do that again, I don't know if you could.
Well, I'm not a singer myself, but as I understand it, singing opera is kind of different than singing musical theater. You need to, like, belt it out there on Broadway. Was that a tough transition?
Well, my teacher had always taught me to be able... She just really wanted me to use my voice at every level. And really, it's like ballet. Ballet is the basis of any good dance. If you have ballet training, it's going to help you do modern, it's going to help you do tap, it's going to help you do what choreographers ask of you, and that's the way, when you train legit, how I view it. It's the same. You know, if you use your voice correctly and take care of it and be healthy about it, it will let you do a lot of different things, and my voice does lend itself to a lot of different genres, and, you know, I have enjoyed that part of my voice and my career.
Let's talk about taking care of that voice. You're the kind of soprano who sings really, really high notes, as I understand it. It's not easy for people to maintain that range. How do you do it?
Oh, goodness. Well, I try to avoid alcohol and smoking. I live a very, very exciting life, Rob. Very exciting. I try to get lots of sleep. That's probably my biggest blunder. I don't have good sleep patterns, but I try to rest. And I try to take care, and I sing every day. Even if it's in the shower, just scales, I sing every day. It's a muscle that you got to use. So you don't use it, you lose it. Also, I'm constantly working, which I'm really thankful for, and that keeps me in shape. So what's tricky is trying to figure out when you're going to let loose. You know what I mean? You've got to do that because you got to live your life. But being on sort of having... tour dates, like three here, four there, two here. It's an interesting place to be. Whereas when you're on a movie set, you see the light at the end of the tunnel. I have dates scheduled for a year. So I just have to live a very healthy life. And I don't mind it. I love it. I love what I do. I feel lucky to get to do it. And, you know, that's what I do.
So you take the rock and roll lifestyle and do exactly the opposite.
Exactly. Exactly. And when I come to your area, I really am praying for warmer weather than cold. I've actually never played Wisconsin. And when I was a freshman at OCU, I had a University of Wisconsin boyfriend. Can you believe that?
Mm.
He played soccer. And he was so used to, we had met in Oklahoma, believe it or not, and obviously it didn't last long because we both couldn't afford to go see each other, but he would always talk about how the cold was good for you, and I always thought, is it? But then again, I'm from Oklahoma, so what do you expect?
Well, let's visit Oklahoma. You were a big part of creating a world-class performing arts center in your hometown, a Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. You've done a lot for arts and education there. Why was this important to you to do?
Well, you know, you go along in your life and you think, how do you want to be remembered? And there's this song I sing at the end of my concert called I Was Here. It's about leaving your mark. And it's sort of become an anthem, and it's a reminder to me of how do you want to, well, one of the ways I want to do it is inspire young people to follow their dream. And one of the ways we're doing that is at the Broken Arrow Performing Arts Center, which I didn't have then growing up. They built a beautiful facility and a gorgeous theater that now probably holds about 1,400 seats. And that's where the Broadway shows tour. And I couldn't be prouder of it. And they actually named it the Chenoweth Theater. And when I saw that sign go up, I thought, well, this can't just be there. It has to mean something. So we started a summer arts camp, and hopefully it's just going to grow and grow and grow. This was our first one this summer, and I've taught two master classes there. And we help kids with training, and we help them go see shows, and we help them get their lessons, and I just love it. I'm very, very proud of it, and I hope I just keep getting it better and bigger and more known, and that's kind of what my journey is about.
Well, you mentioned Broadway. A lot of Broadway fans will know you in large part for your role as Glinda in Wicked. What was it like to live in her shoes for a good long run?
Well, you know, she had some pretty shoes, I gotta say, and they were really sparkly. I enjoyed her. You know, I think it's Dolly Parton that says about her, all of her songs she's written, I love all my kids, just some better than others. And that's the way I feel about the roles I've done. I've been so lucky to get to do really different, like completely opposite parts, from Glinda to Promises to all of Snook on Pushing Babies on TV, West Wing, Glee. It's all been different parts. I think for me, getting to play an iconic role and have her looked at from a different set of eyes and a different way was the most fascinating part of her. She was really, in the beginning and throughout most of the show, the mean one, and no one knew that. She was the wicked one. And it's the tides that turn and how you change and evolve. And you see Glinda evolve and change for the better. And that is a message that I liked. And I knew when I read the script that this show was going to be special. I didn't realize how special, but I'm really thankful. I wanted to be a part of a show that ran and that, you know, stood the test of time. And here we are 12 years later.
I wanted to ask you about a new challenge in the world of theater and musical theater. Actors, singers in the past didn't have to contend with cell phones going off in the audience, or I think in one case somebody actually trying to charge their cell phone on a stage prop. Have you ever encountered that, and did it throw you? How did you deal with that?
Oh, I encounter it all the time, and I encounter it in my concertizing too. I, for example, we had on the 20th Century this past spring on Broadway, in a very silent moment, this play takes place in the 1930s, late 30s, and obviously a phone went off, and I just said, I don't think that's the radio, and, you know, everybody laughed, but I try not to scold people too much, but I want them to know we notice. But it's getting to the point where I'm getting frustrated, because people, I think they think they're at home, and you know, there's people that putting their feet on the edge of the stage like they're leaning back, just chilling.
Oh, no.
And, you know, there's a respect for the theater, I feel, that we must keep and honor. And that kind of, you know, at the risk of sounding like a fuddy-duddy, that kind of behavior doesn't farewell for us. So I really like it when I see young people, you know, dressed, coming to the theater and, you know, respectfully listening. And because the whole point is you want people to have an experience. And they can't have an experience if they get their phones out and they're texting. It's impossible. So that's the only, you know, obviously I'm glad we have the technology we have today. I mean, I'm on the phone with you now in a car going to the airport. So, but I'm frustrated with the live theater aspect and concertizing. And, you know, there was a time when we didn't answer the phone for 2 hours because we were at a play or we were at a movie. Now people are like, where are you? Why didn't you answer your phone? Well, I was in a movie or I was at dinner. And people, you know, I get a lot of funny looks. I'm not going to use my phone this time. I'm not going to pick up my phone during dinner because we just do it now. So maybe the etiquette will switch. I hope it does.
Kristen, I grew up watching the Carol Burnett Show, and I understand, I read earlier this summer, she was with you when you got your star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and she just was in the news yesterday saying you are in a lot of ways her comedy successor, you'd be the person capable of doing her show today, in effect. How do you feel about that, having that legend say something like that about you?
There's no better feeling in the world than to have the person that you admire the most, that was a huge influence on you growing up, say that about you. She did it all. She could sing, dance, act. She was hilarious. She was beautiful. But she was never self-aware. She just had fun. She was a hard worker and a first, you know, leading a company, a true company of genius actors. And there's no ego. So I look at her and I think that's who I want to be like. And the fact that she says that, you know, a really big honor. I'm trying to think about doing that. It's interesting time. I think people would love to see something like that. I know it's costly. And, you know, all I can say is I should be so lucky to even get to do it one time. And how fun would that be, you know?
And Kristen, before we let you go, I don't want to spoil your show here in Wisconsin, but what could the audience expect?
So, like, they can expect everything. Like we discussed earlier, my voice did a lot of different things. So obviously country music was a great influence on me growing up. There'll be a little bit of that. There'll be some opera. There'll be some obviously songs people know me for, and I think songs people want to hear, and new stuff. It runs the gamut. One thing about my show, nobody can ever blame me for doing one thing over and over because it just doesn't happen. I'm really excited to get there. It'll be my first time to play there. And, you know, I like to come to new places, and this is a first for me. So thank you for your time.
Kristen, thank you, and enjoy your visit to Wisconsin.
I will.
That was Tony and Emmy Award-winning singer and actress Kristen Chenoweth. She'll be performing at the Overture Center in Madison on Sunday, October 4th.
Well, Wisconsin unemployment has been better than the national average. There are some areas of the state that deal with unique economic challenges.
Many of the state's northern counties face hurdles that cities like Madison or Milwaukee don't have to think about. Officials from the region came together recently for the first ever Grow North Strategy Forum.
The meeting brought together business owners, educators, and government leaders to talk about the challenges and plan for the future. Joining us now is Tom Still, president of the Wisconsin Technology Council, who attended the first Grow North Strategy Forum. Tom, welcome back to Central.
Oh, pleased to be here.
Well, Tom, what is the Grow North Strategy Forum setting out to do?
The Grow North Strategy Forum is really setting out to try to identify a few key areas where that regional economic development group can focus in the coming years. They are a multi-county group, and so they're really trying to look for solutions to economic challenges and opportunities in those counties that really cut across lines of economic growth and workforce and just some specific things that are unique to that region.
Well, let's talk about some of those specific things unique to the region. What kinds of things broadly is this forum looking at?
This meeting really tried to focus on the notion that certain natural resources, forest products and paper, are key to the region, and how to do a better job of sustainably harvesting that resource, which is historic in Wisconsin, overcoming some hurdles that are in place around that, and making sure they can get that product to market, which is often a challenge around rail, because trucking isn't always the most efficient way to do it. And finally, the workforce itself, as it relates to forestry and paper products, which, like many workforces in Wisconsin, is aging and needs to be replenished. They also spent a lot of time talking about broadband. Broadband is an issue of deep concern in much of rural Wisconsin, and especially in the North Woods, because that connectivity is so essential to everything, whether it be education, health care, economic growth, e-commerce, manufacturing, you name it. Broadband really applies to just about any industry you can find in that region.
Now, in terms of who's involved here, this is 11 counties and different groups of people. Who's coming together and where are they from?
This group was made up of a mix of folks from the education world, for starters, and by that I mean K through grade. There were folks there who represented school districts and technical colleges and really focused on all of the educational spectrum. There were people there who were, I would call, economic development professionals. And of course, people from business who were very engaged in the conversations. I would say it is centered in Oneida and Vilas counties, but it really runs pretty much up to the border with Michigan and east to the Green Bay region.
Now, you were talking about the forest products and paper industry. How important is that industry to those nine counties?
It's very important. In Wisconsin overall, if you look at the manufacturing sector, roughly 12 to 13% of all jobs, wages, and shipments are tied up in forest products or paper products. So it's a big segment overall, and in the North Woods, of course, it's bigger because that's where a lot of the resources are, and it's a historic strength in Wisconsin, of course, and one that as we move forward is going to remain important.
Now, I know the group also talked about attracting and retaining talent to that region. Why has that been difficult?
Well, I think it's difficult pretty much anywhere you are in Wisconsin, with a few exceptions. And the reasons for that are that demographics don't always work in our favor. We're a slightly more aging state than some others. Our immigration rates are somewhat lower. We have reached the point where it's just going to be difficult to replace all of the workers who are aging out of current jobs. In fact, the estimate is that over the next 10 years, there will be at least 1 million jobs that have to be filled over that time span in Wisconsin. And the workforce is not expected to grow at that rate. So in the North Woods, there are probably more challenges just from out-migration and not enough in-migration to replace that. And so I think as they move ahead, they really should focus on the fact that it's a great place to live. It has the right culture and resources and can be attractive to young people. So it's a statewide issue. It's no less severe in the North Woods.
Now, going forward, what are some first steps that you see Grow North taking to try to address some of the issues we were just talking about?
Well, I think that will be, up to the leadership of that organization. But I do believe they will focus on making sure that the educational system is attuned to meeting the needs of industry, and that industry is attuned to understanding what the requirements are. I think they will also focus on being an attractive place to live, work, and play. I think broadband will remain a huge part of the formula, because in order to have a more diverse workforce and a younger workforce, those connections are necessary. And so there's already been some strong progress, especially in Vilas and Oneida counties, around getting better broadband connections, and I expect that to continue. And finally, I think they'll take a look at on the natural resources side of making sure that there is good access to the timber lands in the region, and really strong connections on the transportation side to get that product to market.
And we leave it there. Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you bet, Veronica.
That was Tom Still discussing a recently formed coalition aimed at overcoming economic hurdles in northern Wisconsin. It's called Grow North.
There's been an overlap between elections and money throughout American political history, with money flowing in and out of campaigns to support candidates for public office.
What's changed in recent years, however, is where that money's going. Today, the amount that's being raised by third-party groups eclipses what candidates themselves are bringing in. Two candidates with significant backing from super PACs have already dropped out of the race to be the Republican presidential nominee. That's Rick Perry and Scott Walker.
Joining us to talk about what their fall says about super PACs and their influence is Ken Vogel. He's a chief investigative correspondent for Politico, and he's the author of the book Big Money, $2.5 billion, one suspicious vehicle and a pimp on the trail of the ultra-rich hijacking of American politics. Ken, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, it's great to be with you guys.
Well, let's start, if we're not following the ins and outs of political campaigns, what exactly is a PAC and a super PAC in particular?
Yeah, Super PAC is a political action committee that can raise unlimited funds from individuals, corporations, and unions. It was sort of created by the 2010 Supreme Court decision in Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission that said that laws that prohibited these types of groups from spending unlimited funds in campaigns were unconstitutional, essentially a violation of the freedom of speech. So one of the big caveats in that decision, though, was that sort of declaration, the stipulation that these groups had to be independent from the campaigns and the candidates in order to raise and spend unlimited funds supporting the candidates. What we've seen in this election in particular is a total abdication of that principle. We've seen groups that are very closely linked to candidates and campaigns raising unlimited funds expressly to back them, oftentimes run by the candidates' very close allies, and this very, very thin pretense of independence that a lot of the good government groups have said really violates the spirit of not just the few remaining laws that are in place that the Supreme Court has not struck down on campaign finance, but also the justices' stipulation that these groups be independent from the campaign.
We'll get into that idea of independence in just a few, but I want to talk about the receiving side of things, the money that's coming in. You mentioned the word unlimited, and that's what one of the things that makes these different than a campaign fundraising itself. The campaign has limits on how much it can take from any individual donor. Nothing like that for the super PAC?
No, not at all. In fact, we've seen the super PACs substantially outraise, as you alluded to, substantially outraise the campaigns themselves. So the super PACs that are supporting these candidates have raised around $275 million. That's a whole lot more than the campaigns are raising. We need look no further than Jeb Bush, the field leader on the Republican side in fundraising, who raised about $10 million into his campaign in the first 6 months of the year. During that same time, the super PACs raised about $100 million. So you see right there the disparity, and it allows these very, very wealthy partisans, these activists, to really get behind a candidate in a way that the campaign contribution limits, as enacted by Congress and upheld by the Supreme Court, envision prohibiting against.
And when political action committees were started, and we've heard of them in the past, there's the notion that they might support a candidate here, a candidate there, a state guy here, a woman running for Senate over there. Now we're seeing these super PACs that are very clearly attached to just one candidate and only one candidate. When did that start happening?
That started happening in about 2012 during the presidential race. We saw that both candidates, Mitt Romney and President Obama, and their allies start super PACs to support them expressly. And if you talk to campaign finance reform advocates, those are the folks who tried to prevent the Citizens United decision and have argued for changes to the law and to the regulations that would sort of dial back the impact of it since then. They say that just the very practice of starting a super PAC to support one candidate is really a violation of the spirit of the rules that say that you cannot coordinate. These unlimited money groups cannot coordinate with a candidate. Well, they say if you have a group, if you have a super PAC that's raising unlimited funds just to support one candidate, then even if they obey the coordination prohibitions that say that you cannot get together to decide how to make an advertisement and have the campaign shaping the super PAC's political advertising or vice versa, just the mere fact that you have a super PAC that supports a single candidate is sort of a violation of the spirit of that coordination prohibition.
Talking to Ken Vogel from Politico about super PACs in the presidential race. So one limit maybe they're running up against, you just mentioned there, Ken. And another one, apparently, Rick Perry, Scott Walker, both had a good chunk of change in their super PACs. But Rick Perry, unable to pay his own campaign staff, bailed out of the campaign. Scott Walker left the campaign saying not enough money coming into his campaign. So it sounds like there are some limits to the power of the super PAC.
Yeah, that's right. And that, you know, while these super PACs can, in fact, take on many of the sort of traditional roles of a campaign in terms of advertising, in terms of even getting out to vote and organizing events, they cannot pay the salaries of the staffers who are required to run a campaign. They can't write speeches for the candidate. There are in fact limits, and it was the test case to see whether a candidate could in fact essentially run a campaign through a super PAC, sort of winking at the coordination prohibitions. In the case of Scott Walker, as well as Rick Perry, we saw that there were limits to that. There were limits to what a super PAC could do for a campaign, and both Scott Walker and Rick Perry were unable to raise the amount of money that was necessary, even to run really a bare-bones type of campaign that could be sort of subsidized and floated by a super PAC. So, you know, they probably ended up, they dropped out. The super PACs that supported them had raised $43 million. Those super PACs probably still have a fair amount of money in the bank that they're either going to be under pressure to return to their donors or find other ways to spend. And the fact that they couldn't spend that money fast enough while their candidates were in the race is a real indication, because if you know anything about political consultants, they find a way to spend the money, because in many cases their salaries are paid, and the amount of money that they make is from commissions on advertising buys. So it's in their best interest to find ways to spend the money, and they couldn't do it because the campaigns were so cash-strapped that the candidates themselves had to drop out.
Does this change the thinking then for a presidential candidate? Hey, we shouldn't work so hard to get those super-rich donors to that super PAC. We should be focusing on getting people to donate up to the limit or however much they can to the actual campaign itself.
I think that was the lesson that some people took away from it. But for other people, it was really a traditional cautionary tale, which is that you build a campaign based upon your assessment of your cash flow. And Scott Walker in particular, maybe not so much Rick Perry, but Scott Walker built a very robust campaign infrastructure with a lot of staffers in a lot of different states, and just simply did not have the fundraising to support that. He probably could have scaled back. In fact, we talked to some of the donors to the super PACs when both of these when former Governor Perry and Governor Walker dropped out, and they said they would have preferred for the candidates to scale back their own campaigns, and the term that they use is live off the land, try to get as much free media as possible while letting the super PAC step in. But you sort of sacrifice some amount of control when you do that. And I think for Walker in particular, maybe not so much Perry, but for Walker in particular, he was probably unwilling to sacrifice that control and to scale back his campaign. probably could have done it, but it would be really a shell of the campaign that he had hoped to run.
You've mentioned that coordination, this rule against coordination between the candidates' campaign and the super PAC is being winked at. How closely are these two entities being coordinated?
Well, in certain cases, I think there is, even if it's not the technical legal definition of coordination, there is what most observers, lay observers, the folks who obsessively follow this stuff like me and probably a lot of your audience, would probably deem to be coordination. When you have actual events, political rallies that are being organized by the super PAC at which the candidate is appearing, which we see in the case of Carly Fiorina, who's surging in the polls, a former Hewlett Packard CEO seeking the Republican nomination. I mean, that looks like coordination, but the laws themselves are very specific, and they say that what coordination entails is actually getting together to talk about political advertising spending strategy to the point where you would have to be able to prove that a specific ad in a specific media market on a specific date was hatched, was planned, was produced and aired in coordination between the super PAC and the political campaign. That is hard to do, particularly when you have a federal campaign watchdog, the Federal Election Commission, that by all accounts is sort of mired in gridlock and toothless and hasn't really pursued a lot of regulatory enforcement actions in recent years.
We're talking with Ken Vogel from Politico, looking at super PACs and whether they can allow big money donors to install the candidates they want.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. Is campaign finance reform an issue that's important to you? Do you think that money is free speech and that donors should be able to contribute as much as they'd like to help their preferred candidate win? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is CentralTimeWPR. We're continuing our discussion with Ken Vogel about the role that super PACs are playing in the run-up to the 2016 presidential election. He's a chief investigative correspondent for Politico.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about the influence of big money donors on the American electoral process? Or do you think in the end it's about getting people to the polls to vote, big money or not? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers. Joanne is on the line in Eau Claire. Joanne, hi.
Hi. In my opinion, money does not equal free speech. I advocate for the repeal of Citizens United, and I would be very much in favor of the movement, which is Move to Amend, which is to remove Citizens United.
Joanne, thanks for the call. Ken, a lot of people out there thinking along those lines with Joanne, probably not going to change in the Supreme Court, it sounds like. Congress probably not going to move fast, so trying for this constitutional amendment. Do you, one way or another, Ken, see these things changing anytime soon?
I don't really see a whole lot of momentum for significant campaign finance reforms in Congress. There is some action at the state level. That's where a lot of the folks who are really advocating for scaling back the amount of money and the influence of money in our politics are looking. Typically, the major reforms come after major scandals, and you have to ask yourself, and a lot of the folks who are advocating for these types of reforms kind of shake their heads because they think that just the mere fact that so much money is pouring into our political process, that a super PAC supporting Jeb Bush can raise $100 million, to a lot of folks, that is a scandal in and of itself. So why won't that prompt reforms? Well, typically, the historical pattern has been a scandal that affects one particular candidate for office or elected official, where we see a sort of quid pro quo type situation where favor is given by a candidate or an official who is elected with help from a particular donor or group of donors. You know, we can go all the way back to the robber barons, and it didn't take too long after that for Teddy Roosevelt to enact some reforms in 1904 that actually barred corporations from giving directly to campaigns, a measure that is still in place, you know, all the way up through Watergate, which saw the passage of the Federal Election Campaign Act. So, Is there a scandal like that out there? I certainly hope so. One sort of pessimistic note that I would sound, I say I certainly hope so. As a journalist who covers this stuff, I'd love to uncover something like that. But it's getting harder and harder to follow the money because so much of this money is being spent anonymously through nonprofit groups that don't have to disclose their donors. So the ability to follow the money and trace it all the way back to the donor who might be funding a group that might help elect a candidate that who then might turn around and do something in office that would be to the benefit of the donor, well, it's getting harder to trace that sort of money trail. And that is a very discouraging development for folks who are seeking reform.
Joanne, thanks for the call. We'll go to Tom next in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi. Yes, I also wanted to comment that, you know, while I consider myself very progressive and I support Bernie Sanders for most of his ideas, I also think that it's important that while we're looking at corporate donations and politics and money from PACs, I think it's also important to notice that I believe that all that should be removed, but I also believe that money from, you know, other groups like unions should be treated the same as PACs. I think money should only come from individuals and, you know, with a limit of, say, $5,000 per household per year.
Tom, thanks for the call. Ken, how do unions and their spending on politics stack up now in this era of the PAC?
Yeah, I mean, unions continue to spend heavily. Unions were, in fact, given greater latitude in their political spending by Citizens United. But the sort of universe of money that the union from which the unions could draw, that is primarily union dues from their members, is and has been on the decline. And so, yes, they're spending a lot of money in politics, and they've always spent a lot of money in politics, but that's not really growing, nor has it really changed substantially from Citizens United. What has changed substantially is the money coming in from individual donors and to some extent from corporations, although that really, you know, there was a lot of hand-wringing about potential explosion in direct corporate spending in elections after Citizens United. That really hasn't come to pass either. I think some of that has to do with the corporate sort of evaluation of risk and the tendency to try to avoid risk by publicly traded corporations that could face a backlash if they were found to be subsidizing a campaign or a candidate, whereas individual political donors, individual wealthy, you know, billionaires, multimillionaires are the ones who have really availed themselves of this new flexibility in spending money in politics, and they're the ones who are really fueling this explosion of money in politics.
Ken, the race is still young. Not a vote has been cast yet. As a reporter covering this stuff, what are you watching for? What is the story you're watching for to emerge when it comes to campaign money?
Well, one of the big things that we're watching, I know a lot of folks are attuned to in Wisconsin, is the Koch brothers and the Koch brothers' influence in the Republican presidential primary. The Koch brothers and their and the donors in their network are poised to spend $889 million in the run-up to the 2016 election. That's both on politics and also primarily on policy, trying to shape public policy. But they have built really a shadow party, and many of these other donors on the left and right are sort of doing the things, taking on responsibilities and building infrastructure that are similar to what we've seen from parties in the past. So the degree to which these new networks funded by individual political donors are willing to wade into the process in ways that parties cannot or that parties do not, that is, weighing into primaries and saying, I like this candidate over that candidate, that's one of the things that I'm watching so far. The Koch brothers in particular have not waded into the Republican primary in a way that they have really thrown the full force of their political network and their spending behind an individual candidate. But if they did that, it really could be a game changer. Likewise, on the left, if we saw huge spending by a Democratic donor, a group of Democratic donors in primaries, it could really change the way that the nominating processes have worked.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Ken Vogel for joining us today. He's chief investigative correspondent for Politico. He's the author of the book, Big Money.
An internationally renowned exhibit is marking its 40th year at Wausau's Woodson Art Museum. As Glenn Moberg reports, there's more to birds in art than meets the eye.
It's opening night at the Woodson Art Museum. a chamber orchestra performs under a giant sculpture of two endangered whooping cranes. For the 40th consecutive year, Wausau is the unlikely host of one of the world's greatest displays of avian art.
We are just so delighted and tickled.
For museum director Kathy Kelsey Foley, Birds in Art has reached a milestone. 607 artists from around the world submitted their best work. Only 102 were chosen.
The cream of the crop doesn't even do it justice.
And as always, admission to the exhibit is free.
Spend a little time with that one here.
What do you find interesting about it?
You know, the spontaneity and honesty. He knows his birds.
Don Rombaut of Milwaukee admires a watercolor by British artist Darren Woodhead. Rombaut's own work has been featured at Birds in Art for 15 years.
90% of my work are birds.
You a bird watcher?
A bit, yeah. You know, where I am in Milwaukee, right on the migratory route, loads of raptors in the fall, all kinds of songbirds in the spring. I think we all care deeply about the birds and the environment.
A storm-tossed raven bristles in a charcoal drawing by Michigan artist Karen Bondarchuk. In 2008, Birds in Art featured her sculpture of a human-sized crow made out of tire scraps, a commentary on the environment and a then-struggling auto industry.
It's called Corvus deflatus, and it was a very large crow.
Bondarchuk believes crows and ravens have much to tell us about ourselves.
I see their behavior as being really close to our behavior. They're intelligent, they're annoying, they're able to adapt to pretty much anything that's going on, and I see us doing pretty much the same right now with climate change going on. Humans are scrambling, trying to adapt.
Andrea Rich of Santa Cruz, California, found long-eared owls trying to adapt to a hot climate and turned the experience into a woodcut image.
Central California, it's hot, and there aren't very many trees, and the tree was filled with long-eared owls. There were about 14, 15 of them in the one tree.
Rich says in California, the people are also trying to adapt.
We're having a tough time out there. It is hot, 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 and very dry. We're in our fourth year of drought. A lot of fires this year. We have to completely rethink our water use.
What appears on the surface to be simple wildlife art often has an underlying political message. Guy Koliak is a New Yorker who finds refuge in his scenes of birds and big game animals.
When you grow up in the concrete jungles of New York and you get down to the barrier beaches of Long Island or you get into the woods, it's like a cathedral. It really is. I was raised going to church, but right now I feel closer to God in the forest.
A contributor for all 40 years, Koliak wants to stop the growth of concrete jungles.
If we keep spreading out and exchanging rivers and forests for concrete and glass, the animals aren't going to live in concrete and glass. If you like wildlife, if you like the outdoors, if you like nature, it's imperative that we try to preserve it.
Last year, the Woodson Art Museum used art to commemorate the extinction of the passenger pigeon. This year's artists hope that the birds they portray will not suffer a similar fate. In Wausau, I'm Glenn Moberg for Wisconsin Public Radio News.
And coming up, Waukesha set to lose 350 jobs as GE moves an engine plant to Canada. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Remember, you can always follow us over at the Central Time Facebook page, join conversations about the issues of the day, some good recipes up there toward the top right now. You can check them out, make them, let them know how they went. Also, feel free to tweet us anytime with program suggestions, responses to things you heard on the air on Twitter, at Central Time WPR. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.